Way through 1 Peter, where we are told that we are sojourners and pilgrims. And that becomes very important within this book of 1 Peter, as Peter is talking about the very things that make that so important to us. If we recognize that we are sojourners and pilgrims, then there are certain things that we ought to recognize about our lives here. And he talks to a great extent about how that ought to change our lives here. He said, because this is just a temporary dwelling, he talked about things such as how we ought to behave as citizens, how we ought to behave as husbands, how we ought to behave as wives, how we ought to behave as workers, or even those that would be the employers. He uses masters and slaves because that would have been the relationship they would have known. But it is for us still a very clear teaching on the way we ought to behave in whatever relationship we find ourselves. And then he starts talking about the suffering of Jesus Christ. And we mentioned last time and talked a little bit out of chapter 4 that he starts drawing some conclusions. Therefore, he says, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, then we ought to live a certain way. He said, because Christ suffered, because of what he did for us, that ought to cause us to change our behavior. We would have had associations with the way the world behaved before, and Paul used descriptions such as in his letters that we were alienated from God, we were children of wrath by nature, he said, that we were the enemies of God. And he said, really, if you accept the fact that Christ did for us what he did for us, he says, that ought to all change. That ought to be the motivating factor, not because somebody tells you to do something, though God does tell us to do things. He says, really, it shouldn't be that is the motivating factor. The very fact that Jesus Christ died, that he suffered, just so I could have a chance for eternal salvation, he says, shouldn't require any more motivation than that. God did for me what he did for me, and that ought to drive me to do for him. Well, he's going to draw another conclusion starting in verse 7. After verse 6, as he's talked about people in the world are partying and they're having a good time as far as pleasure of the world, and he says, really, we've had enough time for that. We need to think differently. And then he's going to draw some conclusions in verse 7 where we read, but the end of all things is at hand, therefore. And he's going to say those things again. He says that the end of all things is near. That's Peter's point. The end of all things, he says, are at hand. I would tell you that's a difficult passage. If you just stop right there, that's a difficult passage, because it's difficult sometimes to tell what the reference of an end is in the Scriptures. And really, you're going to see that really there could be three different ideas here, but I really don't think that's going to make a difference here in 1 Peter chapter 4. There are ideas regarding this that he could be saying that this is literally the end of the world is at hand. Now, that would be a little tough to understand now, telling them that it was near and they need to think about certain things because it was very near when we are now some 2,000 years removed from that and haven't seen that happen yet. But it could mean that. He could be saying that the end of the world, because he's going to talk about later in his letters, he's going to talk about the end of the world. He's going to talk about a new heavens and a new earth and talk about the earth being burned up with fire. He's going to talk about things that are the end for sure. But he could also, to these people, keep in mind this was written somewhere in the mid to late 60s A.D. Most believe maybe somewhere around 66 or 67 A.D. And so he may be referring, in fact, to the end of the Jewish world or system to them. That you're about to see all those things that were prophesied in Matthew chapter 24 about the destruction of Jerusalem and how that was going to come about. Well, that was very much at hand for them. If this was written around 67 A.D., anywhere in that area, they're only 3 years away from the defeat of all defeats of the Jews, where no stone is left unturned, where they burned down all of the things that meant anything to the entire Jewish system, where the Romans have now come in and destroyed the Jewish system by destroying Jerusalem in its entirety. He may have had a reference to that. Some believe that this reference is to the end of things as they would have known it, as if everything about society is going to change. But then you read some other commentators, and it may even mean the end of all things for you. He says the end of all things. It's interesting because if you look in the beginning of the chapter, he's saying, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind, for he who suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh. That's how he starts this particular section. He's saying, let's talk about the time you've got left in the flesh and how you ought to spend the time that you've got left in the flesh. He says, because it doesn't make any difference. On other occasions, the apostles said things like, our salvation is nearer now than the day when we first believed. We understand that. We understand with every passing day, with every passing year, it doesn't matter how long you live, the end of your life is closer today than it was yesterday. I mean, that's just a natural fact of life. And so he may very well have been referring to them, especially because of the persecution that they were about to endure. During this process, and as you come into the war that the Romans waged on the Jews, which culminated in this ultimate defeat in 70 AD, then you're going to see terrible things happening under some of the Roman leaders. The incredible persecution. When we're studying in the seven churches of Asia in our classroom study, one of the things that is said on one occasion to a church is that you need to be faithful unto death. He wasn't talking about until you die of old age. He was saying when they're about ready to cut your head off. You still need to be faithful. When they're about to impale you, you still need to be faithful because that's what they were facing. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be faithful all the way to old age. We should. But they weren't anticipating old age. There was great persecution of them at this time, of the Romans to the Jews and then also the Romans and the Jews toward the Christians. And so he's going to say, you know what? I think he's really going to help us understand it really doesn't make a difference which one of these is the reference here, because the point is the end of all things is near, therefore. Whatever it was that he was addressing in their life, whether it was the end of all things or if it was the end of all things as they knew them or if it was the end of all things in their life. His point is the conclusion that he's drawing based on this. He's saying regardless, he says, we are close to some culminating event, he is telling them. Therefore, there are certain things that they ought to consider. And that's the conclusion he's going to draw. We've talked about that before. You need to look for those, when you're studying biblically, you need to look for those kinds of statements. But statements, or therefore statements. Because the writer is saying what's important is what's coming after. He's saying it's important because something's going to happen. But what's important really is what comes after. And what it is that he's going to tell us. And he's going to tell them several things in verses 7 through 11. But he starts off by saying the end of all things is near. Therefore, be serious and alert in prayer. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers. He's saying, think about that. He says, there's not a lot of time left for any of us. Even if you're young and you live to a good old age, we're still talking, in the timeline, you're talking about this little sliver of time. That's just not much time. Now, I know that seems odd if you're 12 or 15 years old and somebody is saying, I'm telling you, you just don't have much time left in this world. That's difficult to understand. But I can tell you, I understand that differently now than I did when I was 12 or 15. I understand it differently than I did when I was 25. I understand it differently than when I was 40. I'm assuming that if I'm allowed by the Lord to make it to 70, at 70 I'll be able to say, man, I understand the brevity of life better at 70 than I did at 58. He's saying, understand, you don't have a lot of time. That's why Paul says things like, redeem the time, use it wisely, don't be foolish. We've got that little bit of time. Moses said, teach us to number our days in Psalm 90. That's the whole point. He's drawing the same conclusion here, and he says, here's what you need to do. He says, you need to be serious in your prayer. The word that's used there in the Greek is sophronio, which it means, literally, it means to be in one's right mind. To be in one's right mind. Also, it carries the idea of exercising self-control. In other words, to put a proper estimate, a moderate estimate upon my own self, so that I'm thinking rightly. That I understand what's important in life. That I'm serious. Or as he says in other places, in chapter 1, verse 13, and also in chapter 5, he talks about being sober. Not literally just not intoxicated. He's saying of serious thought. He says, make sure your prayers understand what's important. And watch. Be alert. Remember Jesus using phraseology just almost identical to that with his disciples? As Jesus went off into the garden to pray, what did he tell his disciples? He said, watch and pray. And he told them again, watch and pray. Why? Because he's saying prayer is not something that you just kind of fly through life with. He's saying, it needs to be very serious. What's really important in this life? He's saying, understand that. Be serious. Be very alert to what is going on. The idea of paying attention to our own life and paying attention to the lives of those around us and paying attention to what's going on in the world. He says, you don't have a lot of time. Make good use of your prayer life. That becomes very important. We need to do that. He doesn't tell us specifically what that is. But if you've got family and you've got friends and you know people who are lost, I would tell you, you know things that are very serious to pray about, don't you? We all do. We understand that. If we think in terms of what's going on in our country right now, there's an election about to happen. Those things affect directly our ability to function for God. We need to be praying about that. That God help us to understand, and that God do what provides us an opportunity to serve Him. We want that opportunity. That's why He tells us to pray for government. So that you can have that good and peaceable life, so that you can reach out to people with the gospel of Jesus Christ. He says, secondly, be fervently loving and forgiving. And above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. He's already told us that about fervently loving. Look back in chapter 1. Verse 22 reads, since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth of the Spirit in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently. He's saying it ought to be a very constant, a very earnest kind of relationship that we have one with another. It is the kind of thing that is above all things. The kind of love that he says will cover a multitude of sins. Doesn't mean cover up a multitude of sins. I think it's probably a direct reference to back in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12, where it says love covers sins. How does that happen? He says it has the ability to get past that, to get over that, to help that person so that relationship can be maintained. Can you imagine a husband and a wife not having enough love for each other to forgive one another? What would you do with the sins? Because that's the only reason forgiveness is ever needed in marriage, is because sin is in marriage. Isn't that right? I say things to my wife that I shouldn't say. I look at her in ways maybe that I shouldn't look at her, or I don't listen when I ought to listen, or I, whatever the case may be, or vice versa. Maybe the same thing on her part. There's many things that can be done within a relationship. What about parents and children? What would happen to the relationship of parents and children if there wasn't enough love to forgive sins on both parts? Children sin. They say things they shouldn't say to their parents. They do things they shouldn't do. Parents say things to their children they shouldn't say and do things they shouldn't do. Love covers that, doesn't it? That's what we count on. We count on the relationship being so strong that a single offense doesn't alienate the people. And that's what he's saying. He's saying brethren ought to be the type that are so loving of one another that they can cover sins, that it has the ability. I think he would tell us we can't be so easily offended that we are bothered so greatly that we can't maintain relationship. He says, brethren have an ability, I think, to go beyond that. Think of some of the things that Jesus told us regarding the love that we ought to have. He says, love, it is the single greatest commandment in all of Scripture. That's what Jesus said. It supersedes every other commandment. That's what he said. First, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. But he says, and second is just like it. Love your brethren. Love your neighbor as yourself. He said, so important are those two things that all that the prophets and the law have ever said hang on those two statements. He says that's how important it is. And that's exactly what Peter's saying. He's saying you need to make sure that that's the kind of love and kind of forgiveness that you extend towards your brethren. We need to love so fervently that we are covering, that we are overcoming when we wrong one another. Thirdly, he says, be graciously hospitable. The word in the Greek is philoxenos, for hospitable, which is an unusual usage of the word. I would tell you that this isn't like its normal use, because he says, be hospitable to one another. The word literally means love of strangers. And Christians are told they need to be hospitable. And that's towards strangers. So much so that there are things said like, you remember probably speaking specifically of Abraham, but saying that there are some that have entertained angels unaware. Remember those angels coming to Abraham? He just sees them as men when they're coming. But he says, hey, here come two guys. They probably haven't had an opportunity to eat. Let's make sure that we kill some animals so that we can cut up the steaks and put on the steaks before these men, and let's make some bread. Let's provide these men bread and let them put their feet up. Let them sit down. He didn't know who they were. That's the word hospitable. It's saying that's the way we ought to treat strangers, people we don't even know. We ought to be inviting into our homes. We ought to be taking care of and being hospitable toward. But this is a different use of that. He's saying that we need to be hospitable toward one another. It's not used that way frequently, because it meaning literally love of strangers toward one another just doesn't sound right, does it? But he's saying the same kind of actions. This is very similar to the idea that's in Galatians when he says, do good unto all men. And he follows that with what? Do you remember? Especially those of the household of faith. He's saying, if this is the way you treat all men, think about how good you ought to treat your brother. He's saying, if you're hospitable towards strangers, think about how open we ought to be in our lives toward one another. He's saying, that's just a natural conclusion, because you can't even imagine the scenario where I would be hospitable towards strangers and inhospitable toward my own brethren. He says, if this is where I am with the strangers, just think of what this relationship ought to be like. Think about how much we ought to be in one another's lives. how we need to be opening up our homes, how we need to be sharing our time with one another. He's saying that we need to do that. You ever had any house guests stay with you? And whether jokingly or not so jokingly. You ever had anybody leave your house and almost the first comment was, I thought they'd never leave. You ever said that? We say that jokingly sometimes. He says, here's the idea. Be hospitable without grumbling. You know what? I'm just thrilled to have you in my home. You know why? What would make me hospitable without grumbling? Do you ever think about that? I think the feature that causes that to happen is when I fully recognize that other people are more important than any possession that I have, including my home. And I'm not going to grumble. I'm not saying invite people in to tear up your house, or I'm not telling you if you have children you shouldn't have your children not take the Hummel figurines off the shelf and throw them at each other. They should be trained to behave properly. But he's saying no grumbling. You know what's really important? Really important is that I just get to share in your life and you get to share in my life. That's what matters. Doesn't matter that I don't have all that I would like to give you. Doesn't matter that the house is a little bit messed up. You know what matters? What matters is that I get to be with you. When I value people more than possessions, then I can be hospitable without any grumbling. None of that matters the same way to me. And that's what he says. Be graciously hospitable. Hospitable to one another without grumbling. And then finally, he says, actively serve God to His glory. He says, and there's different ways really that you can do this, different focuses that he has. He's going to end up giving us two examples, but he's going to start off just by saying, as each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. What have you got, he says? What have you got that God gave you? Because he gave all of us something. And I would dare say he gave most of us more than what we give him credit for giving us as well. I mean, we like sometimes to feel that we are the one talent person. And I don't think there's as many one talent people as we think there are sometimes. I think God's given us multiple abilities, multiple opportunities. He's saying, whatever it is that you have, are you using it to the absolute best of your ability? Whatever it is. He says, whatever God has given you, serve with that. Because He's given you something. And if you think you have no gifts, then your complaint is not with yourself, your complaint's with God. Because God says that He has gifted us. He says, as each one has received a gift, minister it to one another. Understanding that God gave it to you to use as good stewards. Use whatever it is that He has given us. And He uses that word, the manifold grace of God. It's multifaceted. He didn't give us all the same thing. Because God's grace is just multifaceted. And so He put all these parts in the body the way He describes in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Saying that some are different. Some are more comely than others. But everyone has a gift. He says, use it. And he uses two different things. I think it's interesting the examples he uses. If anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. If anyone ministers, let him do it with the ability which God supplies. He says, you have a speaking role? Then speak for God and speak God's word. You have a non-speaking role? Then serve God the way God says. Isn't that interesting? He says, those that speak, speak like God says to speak. Those that aren't speaking, those that are just serving, serve like God says to serve. Both are equally important. Two examples, but he's saying, therefore, since we know this, whatever time we have left, I mean, go home if you want and calculate. Let's suppose the Lord allows you to live to a good ripe old age of, say, 80 or 90 years old. You know, because God says that's beyond regular expectancy of life. We understand that. Anybody lives to be 90 is longer than what God says is a standard life. Calculate how much time you've got left. If you're like me, even if He gives me 90, I'm nearly two-thirds of the way through that. I mean, that's... What if He doesn't give me 90? What if He gives me 70? I've got 12 years left if He gives me 70. What if He gives me 65? I mean, it's a very sobering thought, isn't it? He's saying we don't have a lot of time, therefore, make sure you're using the time wisely. If you're not a Christian, you can't use that time wisely, except that you start using it wisely. There's no way to use it wisely if I'm not using it for God. You need to make sure that you have God first in your life. That your goal is to do what God has asked you to do. Well, what is that? Well, here's all He's asked you to do. Take up your cross, deny yourself, and come follow Me. That's what He said. How can you join yourself to Him? The Bible is very, very descriptive in that way. And He talks about our belief. And He talks about us turning away from our life in repentance and walking toward God and confessing the name of Jesus Christ before men and being baptized into a relationship with Jesus Christ. If you already understand that and want to do it, we hope you'll do it today. If you don't, talk to us. We'd like to sit down and examine that more with you from His Word. For those of us that are Christians, whatever time you had yesterday, you got less today. I know that sounds dismal, but here's the bright side. Right now you have today. God gave us today. Let's use it. If He gives you tomorrow, let's use it. That's what He's saying. Let's use it wisely for His sake. If we can help you respond to His call, let us know while we stand, while we sing.